And the question is, should we keep taking the tabloids? Question mark. I've specifically subtitled this lecture, The British Press, from around 1969 to 2000, because over the last 16 years, as we've already discussed in some seminars and we'll discuss in the seminars afterwards, things have changed. Not hugely, not radically, not drastically, but there is a sort of sense that things are moving slightly. So the question, should you actually choose to go for question 8, to actually outline how the agenda was set by British tabloids, may be open for discussion and debate in a little bit more fulsome a manner than it had been previously. And really what I want to do today is to examine the changing nature of the British press over the last 30 years or so of the 20th century. We've looked, obviously, in recent weeks at the broadcast media, and indeed next week we consider the way in which the national press responds to television. But we're back very much with the printed format in journalism in terms of the reporting continuity and change module. We'll look today upon the comparative performances of different titles. For instance, why did The Sun, as a newspaper, succeed so spectacularly over this particular 30-year period, whereas the Daily Star always seemed to be threatened with closure? Why does the Daily Mail consistently outperform the Daily Express, even today in terms of sales? And we look too at the changing nature of the content of Britain's national press, the differing characteristics of the tabloid, and the broadsheet focus. Question as to whether the divisions between tabloid and quality news values have been blurred over the years will also be considered. And this notion that commentators have often felt that the quality press, the Times, the Guardian, the Telegraph, have actually dumbed down their content will again be addressed as we develop the session today. But before examining a number of individual titles and focusing on the content of tabloids, which after all is at the heart of this whole piece, I want to actually start by highlighting the different economic criteria that are used to dictate the success or otherwise of titles in both the broadsheet and the tabloid market. And I've titled this quite literally Survival of the Fittest. Are we talking about the whole notion of an economically successful newspaper? How do you go about ensuring in the late 20th century that you're not just an altruistic, self-sacrificing oligarch who wants to plough thousands of millions of pounds into a newspaper? You want to effectively sort of make sure it will make a living and be able to be self-sustainable. Well, as far as the broadsheets are actually concerned, for commercial success, they rely primarily on advertising revenue. It's the range of advertisers and the status of the advertisers that really influenced how successful the broadsheet actually is. The finances of the upmarket broadsheets are always going to be advertising driven. Why? Because they can charge the advertisers high rates for access to an affluent readership. If you are an A1, B1, C1 member of society and you've got a lot of disposable income and you're on a six-figure salary or thereabouts, you're more likely to be a broadsheet reader. The broadsheets are therefore attractive to advertisers who sell expensive consumer products. Things like expensive cars, expensive clothes, expensive holidays. And in order to remain a suitable place for advertising higher salary jobs, if you're looking for job areas in journalism, in public relations, in any of the kind of artistic fields, you know, we'll usually point you in the direction of the broadsheet market. Or if you're looking for chief executive officers or vice chancellor's posts or any of those aspects, you know, in order for areas to be advertised and to have high rates for advertisers, the broadsheet newspaper has to ensure that a high proportion of its readers are both educated and affluent. In other words, everybody in this room. So whilst the upmarket newspaper wants more readers and the revenue from sales that it brings, it only wants more affluent and preferably young readers whom the upmarket advertisers want to reach. It was estimated in 1993 that the Daily Telegraph, which is arguably the most successful daily broadsheet, was earning in advertising revenue alone, per copy, 10 times that of the Sun newspaper. So clearly it's successful in terms of generating cash from advertisers to work from that point of view. In the case of the broadsheets, then, bear in mind that raising one's circulation doesn't necessarily enhance the profitability of the title, particularly if the additional readers that you gain are of the wrong sort. And the Times newspaper, before it was taken over by Rupert Murdoch, actually found this to be the case in the 1960s. Between 1966 and 1969, the paper increased its circulation by 60%. How did it do this? Well, advertising itself, so heavy advertising, and adopting a much more popular editorial style. However, a considerable number of the new readership of the Times were penniless students, lower middle class folk, and even working class people. This immediately prompted protests from advertisers who objected to paying high advertising rates for the privilege of reaching large numbers of people who couldn't actually afford the products that they were trying to sell. And consequently, advertising failed to keep up with the rise of circulation, and the paper actually suffered heavy losses. As a result, the Times reversed its policy, it raised its cover price, it adopted a more serious and sober editorial style, and lost 96,000 unwanted readers. So again, in terms of the target that it's looking for, it's an interesting strategy that the broadsheets applied. When the Times went for rapid growth again in the 1990s, it deliberately targeted Daily Telegraph and Daily Mail readers whose consumption patterns appealed to advertisers. And again, that was under the auspices of Rupert Murdoch. So consider the tabloids. Whilst the broadsheets rely primarily on advertising revenue, the tabloids are dependent primarily on sales revenues. And as a consequence, the tabloids such as the Sun, the Mirror and the Star, in other words the red top tabloids, are in a continuing sales war with each other. In order to retain profitability, sales have to be maximised irrespective of the spending power of the potential reader. The mid-market tabloid Today, the Today newspaper, which was launched by Eddie Shah in the 1980s as the first colour tabloid newspaper, actually closed down with a circulation of 573,000. That was significantly more than the broadsheet Guardian or indeed the Financial Times. But even 573,000 readers was not sufficient to keep the paper alive, and so it was closed down. The fate of Today also echoed that of a number of popular titles which were not quite popular enough, which were closed in the 1960s. Titles which have now kind of lapsed into history. You can still access them through archives, but their days as regular newspapers have gone. The News Chronicle closed in 1960, even though it was selling 1.1 million copies. And in 1964, the Daily Herald, with a circulation of 1.3 million, was relaunched as the Sun newspaper. There is a suggestion that these mid-market, middle-brow newspapers also lost a lot of ground to television in terms of the areas and copies that they were likely to be covering. So let's consider three sections of the national daily market over the last 30 years or so. First of all, the notion of the down-market tabloids, the mid-market tabloids, and the quality press. Sales of down-market tabloid titles grew slightly from 1965. Then you would pretty much get average sales for a tabloid newspaper of around about 35 million on a weekly basis. In 1995, that had raised to 44 million weekly sales for the tabloids, collectively. However, there was a big, big switch in which was the dominant company. In 1965, the Mirror Group was dominant in the market sector. By 1995, the Sun's success made Rupert Murdoch's News International the leading company. Bit of background in terms of Rupert Murdoch. An Australian, he actually had had a relatively successful business in Australia before, in November 1969, purchasing the News of the World. He followed shortly with the purchase of the Sun newspaper, and its sales grew rapidly in the 1970s. How did he actually do this? How did he raise the sales of the Sun? Well, generally it's argued that in terms of moving from sales of approximately 1 million by the time when he bought it to 3.5 million by 1975, it wasn't necessarily the publishing of a female nude per day on the page 3 image that explained the Sun's rapid growth. The paper actually grew most quickly in the year before they actually introduced the page 3 image. According to Jeremy Tunstall, there were several more important factors behind the newspaper's success. Rupert Murdoch and the Sun's first editor, under Rupert Murdoch, Larry Lamb, had noticed that daily papers had been pitched above the Sundays in terms of quality, in terms of approach, despite the fact that the Sunday newspapers, like the News of the World, actually had higher sales figures, also the Sunday People and so on. And both Rupert Murdoch and Larry Lamb felt that there was a place in the national daily market for a title that emulated the down-market sensationalism that had characterised the News of the World pretty much from its launch in the 1840s. So we're almost back to the days of W.T. Stead and the Pall Mall Gazette, and using sex, sensationalism, scandal, gossip and things to really drive people's interests and obviously attract them to purchase the newspapers. In short, Rupert Murdoch felt that the popular dailies were overestimating the tastes of the British public. Accusations were made that Murdoch was producing dirty newspapers in the shape of the News of the World and the Sun, not least by David Frost on a London weekend television chat show, in which he actually sort of accused Murdoch of, again, deliberately tarnishing good quality journalism with scandal, sensationalism, muckraking, and so on. The Private Eye instantly labelled Rupert Murdoch the dirty digger. And as Sun editor Larry Lamb adopted much from the News of the World, it's understandable to see that the style that the Sun took to develop in terms of this led latterly, in the latter part of the 20th century, to this accusation of checkbook journalism, press intrusion, overcoverage, overzealous coverage of the royal family and celebrities, paparazzi, and so on and so forth. But it was nevertheless a very successful way of operating. What did Larry Lamb actually do with respect to this whole new relaunch of the Sun? Well, he abolished all the specialist news jobs, except the political journalists, who he actually kept on board, and even now under Trevor Kavanagh, as the news editor of the political aspect of the Sun, still remains a sort of key element within the Sun newspaper. And the focus was very much designed for human interest, entertainment, sex, and sport. Those were the key four areas they wanted to develop: human interest, entertainment, sex, and sport. The Sun newspaper itself was heavily advertised. Not advertised that it covered, but it was actually advertised externally, using television as a key driving force. Lots of adverts for the Superstore Away Sun. Lots of marketing ploys were also used and developed, such as promotional contacts, promotional contests. Aspects such as Sun Bingo were developed as well. And perhaps Murdoch's most important innovation was the introduction of a thing that we refer to as sale or return. News agents were actually deluged with copies of the newspaper, but they only had to pay for those that they actually sold. Any unsold copies of the newspaper could go back to the warehouses and be pulped or developed. This is one of the reasons why even today you see large chunks of tabloid press compared with slightly smaller piles of the broadsheet press. It's quite a deliberate strategy in terms of what you see when you go into your supermarket, your news agent and so on, and you look at the newspaper areas that are actually there. Inevitably, the Sun became Britain's biggest selling newspaper in the winter of 1977 to 1978, when it overtook the Daily Mirror, whose sales had been in steady decline since the late 1960s. Now, whilst arguably the Sun never underestimated levels of taste, perhaps actually the Daily Mirror overestimated the earnestness of its readership. The Daily Mirror had developed a good reputation as a campaigning newspaper with Labour sympathies. Under its editor, it had a mission to educate. Murdoch and Lamb were very dismissive of the Mirror, and especially its three times a week pull-out supplement, which was entitled Mirroscope. It was a kind of tabloid Guardian containing in-depth material about science and the arts. According to Larry Lamb, Miroscope was a pull-out all right. It was pulled out and thrown away. The top decks of buses were ankle-deep in copies. In other words, the public were not interested in culture, in any kind of critical review, any kind of analysis. They wanted sport, they wanted sex, they wanted scandal. They wanted exactly what the Sun newspaper was providing for them. The Daily Mirror during the late 1960s was admired in the newspaper industry for the quality of its journalism. But crucially, it was also losing touch with younger working people as a result of its overcautious and responsible approach to news coverage. For instance, the Daily Mirror actually played down the Moore's murders in 1966 when even its mid-market rivals, such as the Daily Express, were prone to sensationalism. As we said, the Sun's sales continued to rise steadily between 1969 and 1978, and its first sales dip in 1978 coincided with the launch of the Daily Star in November 1978. The Daily Star was started originally to use the spare capacity of the Manchester presses of the Daily Express, and it was planned to compete with the Sun, but it's never really done so at any really successful level, despite the use of a number of ploys ranging from the bingo wars of the 1980s, price reductions, and a disastrous plunge down market in 1987 when it moved into soft pornography. Arguably, when Richard Desmond took over the newspaper and the Express, it still kind of plays around in the soft pornography area as well, being, of course, the sole home of the Page Three girl these days. Between 1986 and 1988, the Daily Star lost 27% of its sales. And one of those aspects which is quite interesting is that the Sun didn't follow the Star into the world of soft pornography. Tunstall argues that the Sun's editors understood their 10 million daily readers. Whilst certainly the Sun has on occasion managed to capture the public mood, the headline Gotcha, with the sinking of the Belgrano during the Falklands War in the 1980s, and the 1990 anti-European cry, Up Yours Delors, overall, it's kind of managed to keep that balance going, although there have been a number of famously costly errors, and expensive ones. Perhaps the most famous one in the Sun's history was its coverage of the 1989 Hillsborough disaster, which we still have resonating with us even today in the second decade of the 21st century. Again, as I'm sure you're all aware, 96 Liverpool football supporters were crushed to death. 3 days after the event, the Sun ran a front-page story, headlined The Truth, which erroneously claimed that drunken Liverpool fans viciously attacked rescue workers as they tried to revive victims. Some thugs rifled the pockets of injured fans as they were stretched out, unconscious on the pitch, and so on and so forth. And as a consequence of this story, again, The Truth, the Sun was boycotted on Merseyside, where its circulation is still disproportionately low. In addition to this fabricated story, never let the facts get in the way of a good headline, the Sun was also responsible for a series of excessive intrusions into privacy and fairly distasteful checkbook journalism incidents. These culminated in the Sun losing a libel case to Elton John, in which they claimed that Elton John was using the services of male prostitutes. The paper employed unsubstantiated testimony brought from a known criminal, and old personal photographs of entirely legal sex acts committed in private. Now, not only were the details of the story untrue, but the details themselves were reported in so graphic a detail as readers of the Sun were shocked by. Again, you can measure this by the kind of response in terms of letters, irate sort of scenarios and so on. It's a delicate balance when you start treading that whole line of what is good taste, what is bad taste, and so on. Elton John was eventually paid £1 million in compensation by the paper, and again, it's largely as a consequence of that initial behaviour of the Sun in Hillsborough, Elton John, and other downmarket tabloids that in April 1989, the then Home Secretary set up a committee, the first of many it would seem, to examine the possibility of the introduction of measures to prevent excessive intrusion into individuals' privacy by the press. This was the Calcutt Committee, and it reported in 1990 that the past two decades, from 1970 to 1990, had seen changes in the character of the tabloid market with a degree of competition not present since pre-war days. This, according to the committee, may have led some tabloid editors to feel let off the leash, to become more intrusive in pursuit of competitive advantage. So in other words, all they were doing was simply trying to push those boundaries of the sensational, the scandalous, and so on, as far as they could actually go, whether or not they actually had supporting backup sources and so on. And why? Well, simply to get more people to buy their newspapers. The content of the tabloids accordingly became less political and more revelatory. It was dealing with the revelatory scandals, the lives of show business personalities, royalty, all these kind of areas which developed this whole notion of the showbiz culture and the fascination that we still have, whether it's who's recently successfully won the Jungle Experience, what Ed Balls' role in Strictly is, and so on and so forth. You're still, is it real news? Is it entertainment news? Again, interesting debate. The ultimate result of the Calcutta Committee was the setting up of the Press Complaints Commission. That was originally designed to replace the toothless Press Council and was to be a much tighter self-regulatory body, which included editors of the tabloids who were to be given the task of drawing up and upholding press guidelines. Interesting to trace the area right the way through to the Leveson report, in which clearly actually appointing editors to police themselves was seen as not the best way to go. However, despite Calcutta's critical review of the press's behaviour in 1993, there were still no changes in regulation. Until, arguably, the death of Diana, Princess Diana, in August 1997, and the connection of the role of the paparazzi in the accident brought about an even tighter code of practice, which the press again hoped would actually mean that continuing self-regulation would prevent the need for external regulation to occur. So where then do we consider this notion of, on the one hand, the down-market tabloids, the Daily Star, the Sun, and so on, and what arguably is the mid-market area, not middle-brow, but mid-market, the Daily Mail and the Daily Express? Well, between 1965 and 1995, the mid-market newspapers in general, as I remarked earlier, suffered a substantial reduction in terms of their market share. In 1965, 49% of national daily newspaper sales were in the mid-market range. So pretty close to half of all newspapers that were being sold were in that middle market range, right across society. By 1995, 30 years later, only 27%, a little over a quarter, of all national daily newspaper sales were in this sector of the market. As I've noted, the mid-market group of titles were badly hit by the arrival of television, dropping from over half the readership to a quarter of the readership, by anybody's statement, is a hell of a plunge downwards. Britain was also committed to its news coverage in a consensual and mid-market approach as far as broadcast television was concerned. Again, reacting to the onset of Lord Reith, the BBC, ITV and so on. And so there seemed to be little place for a mid-market area to really sort of say, well, let's just focus on positive news or issues that kind of don't look to scandalise and develop various other areas within that. Clearly, the upmarket and the downmarket shares of the national newspaper market were prospering. The upmarket news offered something more demanding than television. In other words, what you would get in the Times or the Guardian or the Telegraph was something which you wouldn't get normally on television, either ITV or BBC, which was a considered intellectual, academic, reasoning, long-form article discussing world affairs, global issues, financial matters and so on. It's a little surprise that even today, no FT, no comment for the Financial Times branding is still there. That if you want to really start underpinning the real facts, look at stories like the Financial Times or newspapers like that to find out what is really happening, as opposed to simply getting overpacked editorialisations on the whole issue. It was therefore seen that what the downmarket newspapers could then do was also locate themselves below television, and also see themselves as complementary to and dependent on television. So if you can't beat television, join up with it. Make sure that you have lots of features that actually focus on TV stars, on TV activities, on news values, on a whole range of things racing from program guides onwards. Now, the Daily Express's readership and sales figures have continued to fall pretty steadily since the 1960s, when, in fact, in those days, the Daily Express was indeed a broadsheet published newspaper that kind of changed its shape in the 1980s to a tabloid. Part of the reason for that fall in the Daily Express's readership was caused by the fact that the readers it had recruited during its growth years, the 1930s and 1940s, were growing old. They were dying. It happens. Human beings have finite lifespans. It's one of the reasons Radio 2 was often referred to as the Coffin Dodgers Network, that effectively, you know, once you actually sort of work your way through that process, what happens, who replaces them, and so on. And the Daily Express's attempts to attract a younger readership have been relatively unsuccessful. There had been a number of revamps in the last 30 years of the 20th century, including the arrival of a high-profile female editor, Rosie Boycott, who effectively sort of was replaced when Richard Desmond took over towards the back end of the 90s. There were a team of journalistic refugees that arrived from The Independent, and there was a slight shift towards the left in a political sense to a position that was still right of centre prior to Richard Desmond's Northern and Shell company takeover. Nevertheless, the position of the Daily Express remains vulnerable, even though it regularly sort of carries with it tales of migrant workers, Britain being washed under migration and immigrants, and of course the fact that we're heading into a second, third or fourth ice age and devastating Arctic ice is on its way. I suppose it's going to be right one of these days. The leaner Daily Mail, on the other hand, began to outsell the Daily Express during the 1990s and continues to do so even today. Until 1990, the Daily Express consistently outsold the Daily Mail. The mail circulation is now at 2.3 million, double that of the Express at 1 million. In fact, only three national daily newspapers increased their circulation during the 1990s, that last decade of the 20th century. When most of you were born, actually. The Financial Times actually found its gains abroad. I mentioned the Financial Times. It's not a huge seller in Britain, but it does sell very well overseas. Again, for people who are looking for real journalism, real focusing on the facts and the issues behind the stories and debate regarding those issues. The Times, as we mentioned in the 90s under Murdoch, used another price-cutting tactic, but this time it tended to work. And the third national newspaper that outsold the Express was the Daily Mail. Now, according to Peter Preston, who was the former editor of The Guardian, the Mail's success was due to two brilliantly professional editors, David English and Paul Dacre, D-A-C-R-E. In addition to David English and Paul Dacre, it's generally regarded that one of the aspects that made the Daily Mail a huge success was having an exceptional proprietor in the late Lord Rothermere. And Lord Rothermere's line was to invest heavily in journalism and in marketing. That's one of the reasons why the Daily Mail still remains at present one of the UK's most profitable papers. Not only does it also bring in significant income through sales revenues, as is required of a tabloid newspaper, but its advertising income is also extremely healthy as a result of the composition of its readership. So it's almost struck that golden aspect, the golden chalice, the end of the rainbow, of getting not only good sales, but also being able to charge high advertising rates because it can deliver the audiences to advertisers who want to actually take out some expensive advertising elements with it. In fact, the Daily Mail has as many social grade A readers as the Times. It also has more ABC ones than the Times and Telegraph combined. So on those bases alone, it's clearly a big player in the newspaper industry. and again, this emerged very much from the 90s, pretty much to the present day, whatever one's views of the slightly unusual editorial stances that it actually takes, it still manages to actually succeed. It captures that audience on two key levels. Peter Preston tends to believe that the future success may be uncertain. And clearly, with the demise of both Lord Rothermere and David English, Paul Dacre is the only one of that original Holy Trinity who actually remains in place. Again, it's interesting to see what happens in terms of the infighting that goes on to actually succeed his occupation of the post. But again, it still has a growing elderly readership. It also has an elderly staff of star names. Its columnists have kind of also faded away. Nigel Dempster, Linda Lee Potter, both famous in their days, no longer with us. How does the tabloid's press factor impact on the quality market? Has it had an impact? Well, as I've kind of suggested, the social composition of the readership of the most popular mid-market tabloid, the Daily Mail, has much in common with that of the qualities of the readership of the so-called quality press. In other words, a substantial number of its readers are professionals with a fairly high disposable income. The Mail's readership isn't significantly different from that of, for instance, the Daily Telegraph. But is the content of the paper, is there a blurring around the edges of this tabloid broadsheet divide? There are some aspects of the Mail's journalistic conventions that have much in common with other tabloids, not least its questionable use of checkbook journalism techniques during the Yorkshire Ripper murder trial of 1981. However, some elements of the Daily Mail share similar characteristics to the broadsheets, such as its fondness for columnists. Now, the proliferation of columnists, like Jeremy Clarkson, in the quality press has been the cause of substantial disquiet, especially amongst some observers who see this as clear evidence of the dumbing down of the quality press. Julian Petley's article, Faces for Spaces, in Bromley and O'Malley's A Journalism Reader, is particularly condemnatory of the non-political columns that have sprung up across the tabloid and quality ends of the market. In other words, whether you're Lorraine Kelly or Jeremy Clarkson or a popular sort of individual person, you're writing on the basis of your own opinion. It's quite clear that it's your own opinion, but you're being paid for the column that you're actually writing. Critics have also commented that the growth of columnists have helped pad out the rapidly expanding pages of the newspapers, especially at weekends. Liz Jones, of course, writing for the Daily Mail and so on. And this in itself has encouraged lazy, bigoted and under-researched journalism to prosper in the place of the expensive-to-maintain foreign news desks and investigative journalism teams, which used to be a staple of the quality end of the market. Why do you actually need to have a department of expensive foreign journalists or journalists specialising in particular areas when you can simply appoint Jeremy Clarkson to tell us how to actually sort things out or so on? Why not indeed? Again, to be discussed. Now, it's not to say that columnists are cheap. William Rees-Mogg was actually paid £60,000 per year for one column for The Independent. That's one column a week. He was then paid £120,000 for two columns a week by the Times in the early 1990s. And Julian Petley also observed that the musical writer Julie Burchill, formerly from the New Musical Express, was paid £120,000 per annum for 2 hours work a week when she was a columnist for the Mail on Sunday. That's the target you should be aiming for. 2 hours a week of work, £120,000 per annum. Lovely jubbly. Petley actually expressed surprise that her column took that long to write. As he concluded in his consideration of columnists' punditry, what you actually get within that field is simply a magnification of the shortcomings of the press as a whole. It doesn't attempt to inform, it doesn't attempt to educate. Rather, what columnists actually do was tell them what the writer thinks the public wants to hear and simply stokes the fires of popular prejudices and mythologies. In other words, it's bigotry over the breakfast table. For the columnists themselves, of course, you could argue it beats working for a living. That dumbing down of the quality press, though, has been seen to be taking place in other ways. For instance, the quality press now pays substantially more attention to popular culture than was the case 30 years ago. A Times-reading High Court judge in the 1960s could be forgiven for asking, "Who are the Beatles?" But in the 1990s, his equivalent, reading the same paper, The Times, could possibly name all of the Spice Girls. Whether, of course, he'd be able to name all of Little Mix, I don't know. The broadsheet's news agenda seems to have much more in common with the popular tabloids than was the case even 15 years ago. When The Independent launched in 1986, it vowed to avoid as much as possible reporting on the minutiae of the royal family and royal family life. Today, that seems to be required reading across the newspaper titles. Recently, for instance, The Times was taken to task for its scurrilous reporting of Prince William's friend's penchant for soft drugs. And we've seen the public relations way in which Prince Harry has gone from stripper in Vegas through to people's favourite candidate for the Invictus Games and so on. Although, as noted, the fact that the news this morning revealed that Nigel Farage is in the running to be Time Magazine's Man of the Year is quite an interesting line in terms of the USA's approach for life and so on. Perhaps as we've already seen in this lecture programme, the area in which the qualities have expanded most rapidly in recent years, of course, is in their coverage of sport. For long, the staple of the tabloids. You would not get the whole range of sports coverage, and you certainly wouldn't get the pull-up supplements in the main broadsheet press like The Times, The Telegraph or The Guardian until relatively recently, or The Observer. In March 1990, The Daily Telegraph launched the first ever standalone national newspaper sports supplement. And in the past decade, last two decades in fact, the section's not only survived in The Telegraph, but it's been initiated by all the paper's broadsheet competitors. The arguments then seem quite persuasive for this argument that the quality press have indeed been dumbed down, partly influenced by the success of the tabloids. Serious journalism is being replaced by journalism light in the shape of columnists, personality-led stories, and features are also becoming increasingly common. And sport, especially football, although admittedly cricket and rugby also carry fair input, as does tennis, but they also have become a critical part of most broadsheets' news agendas. On the other hand, there is evidence to suggest that the dumbing down of the qualities has been slightly overstated. It's not all doom and gloom. The quality press have a much greater share of the marketplace now than was the case 45 years ago. In 1965, 13% of national daily sales were of upmarket titles. In 1995, that figure was 20%. It kind of is hovering around the sort of 18 to 20% at present. And whilst the coverage of popular culture and sport has increased substantially within the papers, those newspapers have also increased substantially and considerably in size. In 1966, the average size of The Times was 22 pages. In 1995, the equivalent figure was 56 pages. And now, again, in terms of size, there's still sort of significant weight that comes through with respect to the broadsheets. Since the arrival of The Sun, arguably the only successfully newly launched downmarket title, The Independent was launched in 1986, although that has clearly now gone online, and The Eye, whilst proving successful, is not necessarily a broadsheet in the traditional sense and is more in the line of the old Middle Brown newspapers. And general surveys and seminars have suggested that actually the general way in which people would naturally take at least one newspaper a week has begun to tail off, which is why I said specifically, if you're looking at this and going back to the original title of this talk, this is very much focusing on the last decades of the 20th century and not progressing to the 21st century and where we sit at present. In contrast to the tabloid press, however, the quality titles still tends to continue to staff foreign news desks in order to ensure a comprehensive foreign news section. So in many ways, it's difficult to stand back and draw overall conclusions about where we see the press has developed. And certainly in terms of setting the news agenda for the latter years of the 20th century, yes, there are clear examples where there seems to be a definite causal link between the story, the campaign, the image, and the result. It was The Sun what won it, being part of the proud boast of the Sun newspaper in the aftermath of Neil Kinnock's failure in the 1987 general election. So a whole range of other issues developing within that, including, of course, the relationship between the press and politicians. And as we said, that shifting round in terms of where politically we have moved within the space of 200 years from press having to be very careful about how they reported on things, how they developed the threat of censorship, the threat of prison, the threat of exile, the threat of taxes, a whole range of things, to an era where, in essence, the shackles of censorship have been thrown off, up to a certain point. What happens in the post-Leveson era is still very much in the melting pot and evolution area. But the reason for our notion there in terms of the athlete on the race and on the final sort of side of things from that perspective is actually, do we keep taking the tabloids? They still are undoubtedly successful. They're not in the state of collapse that the provincial press appears to be. Whether we can talk about that in 100 years or so from now, that you'll have to use your own time machines to find out. Thanks for listening, and I will see you, some of you in seminars, and probably more of you at the grand event at the upper bar deck of the thing that's happening at 5 o'clock. It's the place over there.